The following talk, Why I Believe in Evolution, was given by Professor Emeritus James F. Crow at the request of residents in the retirement community where he now lives. Crow is distinguished for his groundbreaking research in genetics and was popular as a teacher. We hope you will enjoy his thoughtful reflections on this controversial topic. This event was hosted by Capitol Lakes in Madison, Wisconsin on December 6, 2010. Now, Professor James Crow, Why I Believe in Evolution.
I'm often asked how long I've accepted evolution, and I don't know the answer. It goes back to my childhood. My father was a biology teacher and a believer in evolution, also a very devout Christian. But there wasn't much talk about evolution in the family table. It was all about household things. And I don't ever remember it being controversial. I do remember as a child in Sunday school, I had trouble believing some of the stories. I didn't believe the story of Jonah and the whale, for example. But I found myself in good company. Sinclair Lewis also has a reputation. That's how he got his start, by refusing to believe this particular story. I didn't believe Noah and the flood either. I knew enough biology, even as a child, to know there were too many kinds of animals to fit into a simple boat. The other thing is that, of course, I was too young to worry about inbreeding, but I should have, with only one pair of each species. In the 19th century, there was considerable question about what to believe about evolution, and I have a favorite quotation from this period. It comes from the wife of the canon of Worcester Cathedral. She's reputed to have said, "My dear, is it in fact true that we are descended from monkey-like ancestors? If it is true, I hope it's not true, but if it is true, let's hope it never becomes generally known." Unfortunately, it's both true and generally known. In my own work, I've spent most of my life studying some aspect or other of evolution. But yet I haven't stopped very often to ask why I really believe this. I just have all along. And in preparation for this, I gave some thought as to why I do. You know, the idea of evolution was not new at the time of Darwin. There were many people who believed that the Earth was old, for example, and that the fossils had some significance, and that there had been a historical evolution, and the domestic animals had evolved thanks to selection, and geographical distribution made sense in views of evolution. But for the most of the biological public, the fact of evolution might or might not have been accepted. It often was. But certainly there was no mechanism, and there was no reason for thinking that it would really work. And this had to wait for Darwin, and that's what Darwin contributed to this. He contributed the idea of natural selection. Up until then, the prevailing idea was really Paley, who gave the example of the watch. I'll repeat it for those few of you that haven't heard it, that if you're walking around and see a watch on the ground and pick it up and examine it, you'll almost certainly conclude from the way all these gears intermesh and work with each other that it had to have a maker. And he said, if that's true for a watch, a simple thing like a watch, then consider the whole of nature, the human organism and all the other organisms, how well they work. Surely there must be a creator that produced all of this. I was aware of this argument, although I didn't know who started it. But I instantly had the same thought that Bertrand Russell did. If a creator made this, then who made the creator? And I worried about that as a child. I got nowhere, of course, and I still get nowhere with that particular point. What Darwin showed us was that you don't need a creator, or you don't need a maker, that the process of natural selection, crude as it is, takes care of it. Let me give an example of natural selection. It actually comes from Darwin. I can't do any better than Darwin. He said that consider a population of deer and wolves. A deer that can run faster escapes the wolves, and it has a chance of reproducing. And so therefore, its children will be run faster than the average deer in the population. And that'll go on until the deer can run faster, only at the expense of losing something more important than running faster. That's all right so far. On the other hand, the other side of this story is the wolves. The wolves that can't run fast enough starve to death, so there's also a selection for the wolves. So we would expect that the relationship between wolves and deer wouldn't change very much, but that both of them would get faster and faster until they could get faster only, as I said, at the expense of losing something else that that was more valuable. With such a simple idea as that, it's utter simplicity, and it bothers me that people don't find it so simple. And evolutionists themselves muddy this picture up by getting into all sorts of arguments about esoteric points that are not really relevant to the big picture. And when I'm speaking about this subject, as I sometimes do, I always emphasize the point that this is the exceedingly simple idea compared with almost all of the other great ideas in science. If you talk about evolution, everybody can understand it. If you talk about quantum theory, nobody can understand it, including quantum theorists, as a matter of fact, or relativity. Only a few people really could master it. Now, why has the public, the educated public, the uneducated public, accepted relativity and quantum theory without question? Actually, it's being questioned now, but it wasn't for a long time. When they didn't accept evolution, which is so much simpler. I don't know the answers, but I guess the answer is that evolution is contrary to what we've been taught, especially through a religious and other kind of heritage. If I look at the current evidence for evolution, it's much stronger than it was in Darwin's time. The fossils are still there, but the fossil record is far more complete than it was. And what used to be missing links, important gaps, have been largely filled in. There's still gaps, of course, but they're much smaller ones. Domestic animals are a wonderful example of evolution. It's on a short time scale, but it shows how it's incredible to think that in just a few thousand years, animals that were wolves, or were wolves, in fact, have evolved into St. Bernards and Chihuahuas and all the other kinds of dogs that we have. That doesn't tell you very much about the nature of dogdom, but it tells you a lot about the nature of human taste to want to produce all of these bizarre forms, which in fact we can do. I spent several years when I was first starting research on the evolution of insecticide resistance. I studied DDT in fruit flies, and I did it in an intentionally crude way in order to mimic nature more. I had a cage of Drosophila that held a few thousand, and I put DDT on the bottom of the cage, and most of the flies would be killed by it, but there were a few survivors. They bred and left offspring, which were also resistant. Then I added more to DDT and went through the same act again. I did that about 15 or 20 times over the course of a year, and by the end of a year, I had a strain of flies that would walk on DDT and love it, or at least they said they loved it. The floor of the cage was just white with DDT. And interesting to me, aside from all this, is that in those days, it was standard belief that DDT had caused no harm in higher organisms. It was strictly something for invertebrates. So we vertebrates, like ourselves, didn't have to worry about it, and I didn't worry about it. So I must have eaten a lot of DDT in my lifetime, my early lifetime, not recently. And it's had a consequence, which I'll announce to you. You're the first to know it, I found that with these Drosophila, which is what they were, that if I fed them DDT, not enough to kill them, but more than almost enough, and then starved them, then they all died. Well, what that meant was that they stored the DDT in the fat. And then when they went on the starvation diet, they started using the fat and got poisoned by the DDT. I use this myself, incidentally. I'm never going on a diet. And if I become too rotund, you'll know the reason why. There are two things beyond Darwin that I want to talk a little about, beyond the simplistic idea of natural selection, I want to say a little bit about. And Darwin was aware of one of these. And this was sexual selection. That is, selection by the mates by mate choice. If it makes no sense, and it doesn't, for peacocks to have these big tails, which are an open invitation to a predator, or a pheasant, or a highly colored fish in a fish pond, we understand the mechanism of this. Darwin did too. It's that females, for some reason or other, I don't have any insight into the mind of a peahen, but she prefers males with big tail feathers. And this selection by females has led to the extravagant development of, or the development of extravagances that are clearly contrary to natural selection, but nonetheless can be understood by sexual selection. There must be a sort of an uneasy truce always between getting more and more ornate, which the females like better, and running a risk of being killed by predators, which goes with the ornateness. And there have been nice experiments done of this sort of thing. Their guppies turn out to be more amenable to study than peahens or peacocks. But in the guppy population, those guppies that grow in a population where there are a lot of predators, I think this is one of Darwin's better ideas. Of course, he had many ideas, but this is one of them. That there'll be many instances in which sexual selection will outweigh, at least to a partial extent, the effects of natural selection itself. And it does mean that organisms that are related to sexual behavior, one way or the other, tend to evolve especially rapidly, because this is a rapid mechanism. And most of the people who classify insects, for example, look for genital characters as ways of classification. You might say this means that entomologists are obsessed with sex. I prefer to say it another way around. I say that the insects themselves are, and that entomologists are simply observing. And I'll say anything in favor of entomologists and against insects. The other thing I want to say a little bit about that's happened since Darwin's time, there are many things that have happened, but this is one of the convenient ones to talk about. And that's, how do we ever get altruistic behavior by a process of natural selection, which is cutthroat, competition, blood and tears? Well, here's one way to look at it. And it provides a clue as to what is probably the proper way. Imagine this kind of a thought experiment. Suppose that I am standing on the shore of a lake, and there's a child out in the lake that's going to drown if I don't rescue it. I calculate my odds of drowning myself if I try to rescue the child at 10%. So the question is, what should I do? Well, the biologist or the evolutionist's answer to this question is rescue the child if it's a first cousin or closer, but otherwise let it drown. I don't advocate that as a moral principle. But what I do say is that gives an idea of how evolution would work. I don't think that animals make this kind of a calculation, of course. But what I do think is the behavior pattern that evolves, it's such as would be predicted by that kind of a calculation. Now, I do think that this kind of selection is important in human ancestry, and that probably we owe considerable amount to the fact that we're as good as we are, to the fact that our ancestors lived in tribes, but more or less like present-day baboons, with small tribes. Within a tribe, everybody's related to everybody else. So if you help somebody else, you're in effect helping a relative. And perhaps I didn't make it clear enough that if I help a relative, I'm helping some of my own genes to be perpetuated, so it's more or less equivalent to my own reproduction on a smaller scale. I find this a very easy notion to understand, and I think it's rather likely that if we had had in our past a particularly homogeneous population, rather than one that was broken up into small tribes, we might not have as much altruistic behavior as, in fact, we do. Now, I don't think this is the sole explanation of altruism, I think much of altruism is really selfish behavior disguised. I help you, you help me, we both benefit. But I think this principle, as we now call it, kin selection, selection for relatedness, selection for preserving those that are related to you, is an important factor in evolution, totally since Darwin. In fact, Darwin would have had no way of understanding this because Darwin did not understand how heredity works, and therefore he couldn't have made the kind of calculations that we geneticists make routinely and that organisms do by implicitly, or behave as if they could. Some of the properties of evolution. One thing to note is that evolution really is a tinkerer. It patches up, fixes up, works on whatever's there, and it doesn't innovate anything really new, usually. It starts with what's already there, and I think many of the things that seem to us to be mistakes in evolution are the result that were the results of history. I'll give you just a few examples. These are things that don't make any sense when you first look at them, but if you look at the history or the embryological origin, they do make sense. For example, there are going to be several people in the audience choke while I'm talking, or at least approximately choke. That's a consequence of the fact of our misplaced esophagus. Our windpipe is in front of the food pipe, and it ought to be the other way around. It's an invitation to choking. Why is it this way? It's because of our biological ancestry. The ancestors of ourselves had these in the other order, and that order has been preserved. Another example of evolution not working very well is the human eye. In some ways, it's very, very good, but it's not as good as it could be. And a squid, for example, has a better eye. Our eye is wrong side out, in the sense that the light has to go through a number of cells before it reaches the light-sensitive cells. The reason for that is the embryological origin and our relatedness to other organisms in which the eye was functioned in what we would say a logical way. I'd use this thing. This is just an example of something that seemingly is a mistake on the part of evolution, and it is, but we can understand it if we simply look at the history of how this came about, both the history in historical times and historical in evolution, in the developmental time of that particular individual. My favorite example of this sort of thing is what's called is the recurrent pharyngeal nerve. This is a nerve that nobody's ever heard of, but it starts as a branch of the vagus nerve off of the brain. And in the developing embryo, we have aortic arches, very much like a fish does. This nerve loops around one of the aortic arches and back to its target. Now, in the course of development, the neck gets longer. The aortic arch disappears, but its successors stay there. And that means that this nerve has to make a hairpin loop. Doesn't make any sense because it should go straight to its target, but it can't because it was started in development going around this aortic arch. In humans, that's not much of a problem. Perhaps the nerve moves a little slower than it would otherwise, or conducts a little slower. But imagine what this is like for a giraffe. In a giraffe with a 15-foot or so length of neck, that nerve has to leave the cranium, leave the brain, go down, loop around this place in what's now in the shoulder, back up again. And that's maybe 30 feet or so of distance of a nerve traveling. Makes no sense whatsoever unless you understand the history of it. There's a charming book written by Dawkins. It's entitled The Greatest Show on Earth. And there's a chapter devoted to this particular example. Dawkins was fortunate. I'm envious. He was able to attend a dissection of a giraffe. The giraffe had happened to die, happily, and happily for this purpose. And they did a dissection of it, and they found, in fact, this nerve looping around, coming back again, following this stupid path of long distance when it wouldn't have needed to. What I'm really saying is that a reasonably intelligent engineer could do a whole lot better job of this sort of thing than evolution has done. One other aspect of evolution, it can't have any foresight beyond the very next generation. There's no way in which you could do something that's momentarily harmful in order to attain a future benefit by this. It would be very nice if we could do that, because there are many times traits in which in small amount is not very good, but in large amount is good. But there's no way in which evolution, actually we think we do understand ways, but they're tricky. There's no way in which simple natural selection can accomplish that. One other thing, two other things. Natural selection has no concern for anybody or anything that's past the age of reproduction, or at least the age of reproduction and child care. Everybody in this room understands this principle without my ever telling you. Any concern that biology has for us disappeared when we stopped reproducing. And as a result, we have all these infirmities of old age that I'd be glad to detail to you, but you know them already. A benevolent creator could have done much better. We're all victims. Another example that interests me and interests all biologists is the development of blindness in caves. Why is it that fish that grow in a cave are blind? Well, they don't need to see. And one explanation really is that the fish that could see leave the cave. And maybe that's a sufficient explanation, but it's also follows on other accounts too. That if something isn't needed, it's usually harmful rather than beneficial, because it's wasting effort that could be put to better use. The thing is that this hardly ever carries itself all the way. Blind cave fish do not have the absence of an eye. They have an eye that simply deficient, doesn't work very well, too small, but it doesn't disappear entirely. If I were a creator, I wouldn't bother to make the eye in the first place. And it makes you wonder why, it's another bit of, for me, reason of showing that evolution leads us to things that would seem unreasonable from an engineering standpoint. One other question that arises in discussions of evolution is, has there been enough time? There's a great story about the famous British evolutionist named Haldane. He was giving a lecture, and a woman in the audience said, Professor Haldane, how is it possible for a single cell a few million years ago in that length of time to evolve into a multicellular organism like you and me? And Haldane's response was beautiful. He said, Madam, you did it yourself in 9 months. In a way, the most remarkable thing really is that it does happen. And it's not, and maybe if you understand it's happening in a 9 month period, it doesn't seem quite so strange for it to happen in a few million years. My current interest of mine, mainly by having a particular student, let me take just a moment for some confessions. I have a totally undeserved reputation as a mathematician, and I live with it and I enjoy it. But it happens because I've had two near genius graduate students who are extraordinarily good mathematicians, and we wrote things together, and we weren't very careful to designate who did what. And so therefore I had this reputation as an expert. Even the great Haldane that I mentioned a while ago was fooled by me, unintentionally. Some time ago he wrote a letter to a friend and said that he discovered a new mathematical function that the French understood and probably hadn't been aware of in the United States yet. Said only the mathematicians would, certainly no biologists would, except for hot shots like Crow. Of course, I'd never heard of that, but I accept the credit. Why not? Nothing to lose. Has there been enough time? There have been serious studies of the amount of time. And I want to use one example of this is to say that the people who are creationists and who doubt the sufficiency of natural selection are not stupid people, and many times they have thought this through very carefully. I have a colleague, I've never met him, but we've corresponded, named Spector, who lives in Israel. And he wrote a paper simply saying that if you do the equations, which he knew how to do, that there hasn't been enough time for the molecular changes that would be required. I think he was wrong, but it was not a stupid argument. And in the use of this argument, he used one of the equations that came from me, ultimately, through one of these mathematician students. And in using those equations, I found that in reading his paper, he made a mistake. There was a factor of two error in it. Up until then, I didn't think much of it. I thought he'd found this in a textbook someplace. But clearly, he had derived this on his own, and that showed by the fact that he made a mistake in doing it. It was a trivial mistake, but it showed that he really understood what was going on. So I mention this just to say that creationism doesn't necessarily apply to just people who are stupid. They're often highly educated, and many of the people who are intelligent design people are engineers, physicists, other scientists, as together with educated people from all walks of life. So although I think evolution is true, and I'm sorry more people don't believe it, I don't want to say that you're stupid if you don't. One of my students, and I by extension, worked out the theory of what happens if you have strictly neutral evolution. Evolution that's driven by just the mutation process, no natural selection, just let things work out. The theory of this can be worked out pretty easily. In fact, I could tell you in 5 minutes, but I won't. A simple way of understanding it. And out of this is evolution then by purely random processes, and it led to quite a bit of debate. How important is natural selection versus random processes in evolution? Up until this time, most of the people gave very little thought to random processes being important. But just about the time that this theory was being developed, molecular biologists were discovering how to sequence DNA in closely related organisms and distantly related organisms. And the remarkable thing was that if you study those parts of the chromosome of the genome, those parts which are non-functional or are not known to have any function, no function we understand at least, that they're evolving at a predictable rate as determined by the mutation rate. This then led to the, for the first time really, for a molecular clock, for a way of basing time in the past based on counting the number of changes that take place. And to me, this has become one of the more important evidences for evolution. That the if we compare, for example, if we compare ourselves with other mammals, cows, horses, pigs, we differ by about 10% of our DNA. And if we compare organisms at further distance, we differ by more than 10%. But if we compare with chimpanzees, we differ by about 1%. Well, that's pretty close to the degree of relationship that chimpanzees have versus other mammals, degrees of relationship to ourselves. And if I compare two different people, they differ by about 0.1%. Not as much as chimpanzees, but not a negligible amount. The fact that all this fits together so beautifully is, to me, one of the nicest parts of our picture, that the DNA chemistry, which at first seems quite removed from any evolutionary study, has in fact told us a great deal about the parts of evolution that we previously didn't even realize existed. That is, an awful lot of the chromosome isn't doing anything that we can understand, and it's clearly not doing anything of great selective importance. I've said evolution makes mistakes and does silly things from an engineer's standpoint, and yet it does some remarkably good things. For a patching up process, it's amazingly successful. Of course, it's had a long time to do this. But here are a few examples. I don't know what yours is, but I have my favorites. I think the elephant trunk is a remarkable thing. This trunk can pick up a tree trunk, but it can also pick up a peanut. And being so delicate and so strong at the same time, it is no small trick, I would say. I think a bird's feather is remarkable. The way these different parts of the feathers tie together in such a way as to permit the feather to work. A dog's nose is an invariable satisfaction. Beyond the world, the dog can smell as much as it does, especially when we can't, is a remarkable fact. And I think, to go back to the human eye, I told you it had some mistakes about it, but one part of the eye doesn't have this mistake of having to go through to other cells to reach the light-sensitive part. It's a part called the fovea. And the light there hits directly on the nerve cell. The remarkable thing about this is that the human eye, if it's dark-adapted, is just about as good as it could be, by which I mean that it can detect a single quantum of light energy. Well, it couldn't be any better than that. So in some respects, evolution has done remarkable things, almost miraculous things, in succeeding and, in this case, limited only by the most ultimate physical principles. And whatever else you think of it, the human brain is a magnificent thing. And the fact that it certainly is, if not the crowning achievement of evolution, one of them. I think it is. Now, if a few other things. If evolution is so simple, if the idea of natural selection is so simple, if the evidence is so strong, why the controversies? First, why are there arguments among geneticists themselves, among evolutionists themselves? There are. These are an argumentative bunch of people, and they argue and argue. The less it's known, the more argument, of course, like any other subject. But what I want to emphasize about this is that the arguments are all about small points that don't really matter. There's almost 100% agreement that evolution is a historical fact, and that that the main determining force is natural selection. And all the rest of this is adding refinements to it, beauty to it, actually, and interesting to it, but doesn't change the basic principle. I think evolutionists might do better in meeting with the public if there was less emphasis on how much we can disagree and more emphasis on pointing out that the large levels of actual agreement. Is evolution still going on? It certainly is in some ways. We are still domesticating dogs, and we're changing them at a rate that's as fast as they've ever changed in the past. I told you about DDT resistance. That happened in a lifetime, in about 1 year in my lifetime. There are other genes that have changed in historical time. There are certainly some human populations that don't digest lactose. And these are populations that can't eat too much milk, but they're geographically distributed in accordance with the dairy eating plans. And then we see every year more and more increase in crop plants, better performance of livestock, so that evolution, at least in human hands, is proceeding at a rate unparalleled in history, and I think otherwise it's happening. Another aspect of evolution we don't like to mention is extinctions. The world is certainly changing in a way more rapidly than it ever has in the past by way of extinctions. Is evolution the last word? Evolution by natural selection? Right now it is, but I want to say that I really have an open mind on this subject. I can see some difficulties in understanding evolution by natural selection. If something better comes along, I'll be the first to accept it. It's not a final theory. It's just the one we have that's best at the moment. What about evolution and religion? Some evolutionists are religious. Most, if they are religious, are deists rather than theists. My own view, as many of you already know from many conversations, is to be as atheistic as non-religion. But I don't hold that other people have to have such a view. My main argument for believing as I do is, why would an all-powerful, all-knowing, benevolent creator permit as much sin and pain as is happens in the real world? I know the orthodox view that this means that the devil got into the act, but I find believing in a devil at least as hard as believing in a God, so I don't find myself, at least, this a very satisfactory explanation. I have a quotation that I like. It's from Bertrand Russell, who said many quotable things. The story is that he was asked one time, Bertie, suppose you die, and I should have told you that he was practicing atheism all his life, suppose you die, And it turns out you were totally wrong. You're taken to the gate, and there's St. Peter, and there's God. And you said, what would you say? Russell's instant reply was, God, why didn't you give us better evidence? To me, that's a rather profound and very clever kind of a, it's typical Bertrand Russell statement. So I don't see sufficient evidence. But I want to close by saying that although my own views I've just stated, you don't have to be an atheist to study evolution. You can be a believer and still do first-rate research in evolution. I promised to leave time enough for questions, and I've done it. So let me have them. Questions, comments.
We all started from one creation and then evolved, saying that God made one man, and then we evolved off that one man. So there is a way that evolution and creation by God can go together.
Except I would want the creator to start earlier than with a human.
He could have made the basic blueprints for certain animals too in that creation. And then like say like a weasel and the otter, you know.
I'm aware of countless possible beliefs of this kind. To me, I find a mechanistic view of this a very satisfying one. But I can't question yours if it's different. Let's just leave it at that. Yeah.
I'm wondering at the persistence of serious mental illness. I understand that the incidence of schizophrenia has been about 1% for a long time. I mean, there may be problems of measurement, but why don't those fade out? I mean, they don't seem functional in a good way.
Well, there are about as many theories of evolution of schizophrenia as there are people studying it, as you would expect. One way of saying is that maybe mild schizophrenia is advantageous by providing an ability to think free of the and uninhibited by what's around you. Maybe some of the great thinkers were slightly schizophrenic in this regard. The other is, though, that maybe there's some kind of a balance that schizophrenia is harmful certainly to the population, but it's not that harmful. And if you have mutation and other causes that are tending to drive the disease lower, they reach a limit pretty soon. And maybe schizophrenia is right at that limit. These are not very satisfactory explanations, but
evolution sometimes works in very wonderful ways. It works in parallel ways among vertebrates and invertebrates. For example, the hummingbird is a vertebrate, a bird, of course. And among invertebrates, the sphinx moth does exactly the same thing. It fills the same niche in nature. So it evolved, as one would say, nature abhors a vacuum. And among invertebrates and vertebrates, it immediately filled that vacuum with an appropriate creature.
I totally agree. There are many examples in evolution of convergence, as we call it, of two different independent groups evolved toward the same end. Incidentally, looking for differences between birds and moths, one thing that can be understood about this, makes sense, is that birds can see red and insects cannot. And so those particular flowers that are pollinated by birds tended to be more often red, and those that are pollinated by moths tend not to be red. So at least in that sense, this particular part makes sense, and the convergence isn't complete.
Many years ago, I had a minister say to me that what he felt was evidence of God's existence, and that was that in all elements, the only element that rises when it freezes is water, and all others sink when they freeze. And he said that was part of God's plan so that the water creatures could live under the water. So,
well, you're not the first to have noticed this. In fact, many, there's a whole book written by a man named Henderson about water, how wonderful water is, and how remarkable it is it has this property of getting changing density with the temperature in such a way as to let the ice float rather than go to the bottom. Well, one way to see it, as you did, as your minister did, that God made water this way so we could live on it. The other way of saying is that the reason we're here is because water has this property. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any humans. I prefer the latter. Yeah.
How does the account of evolution over six periods of time compare with in the first few chapters of Genesis?
Well, I don't find the first few chapters of Genesis very convincing, Richard. I think all scientific evolution points to the fact that the Earth and the universe are millions of years, even billions of years old. And I simply can't reconcile that with the early chapters of Genesis.
One day, 2 days, 3 days, and so forth, mm-hmm. They're not thinking of 24 hours. Even the Bible says that 1,000 years are but as a day with the Lord.
Well, if you make that a million years, it maybe makes sense.
It could be, but...
I certainly agree, though, that there's no reason to think that God kept the same system of timekeeping that you and I prefer.
But how does the order that you hear in the early chapters of Genesis compare with the theories today about what was on the first period of time? What was in the second period of time first? Was it diffused light and then planets and so on like that, and then... fish and then animals and humans. I forget the rest of it right now. But how does that fit in with some of the theories today?
I'll tell you one way in which it doesn't fit. And that is if you read Genesis, you find their night and day was here before the sun. Mm-hmm. I find that hard to understand.
Well, except diffused light without
the moon. Yes, I could, if I were sufficiently clever, I could invent a mechanism. But the long and short of this really is, I think that although I'm very tolerant, I'm very sympathetic to the view that there might be some sort of supernatural mm-hmm. force involved. But I can't see any way of reconciling geology and paleontology and cosmology with the 5-day origin of the Earth. Yes.
I just wanted to go back to the idea of the why does schizophrenia persist? Uh-huh. And it seems to me a possible answer would be that one, the type of gene it is if it's a dominant recessive, it would have more power to continue. And it doesn't necessarily interfere with reproduction. And as long as you have reproduction and the additional generations with those genes, it will persist. I think something that would make an organism sterile would probably not persist in the same way that something that doesn't interfere with reproduction.
Well, you have a good point, and I should have made it. And that is that maybe one of the reasons why schizophrenia and many other diseases of old age or adult age persist as long as they have is that there isn't much selection for traits beyond the age of reproduction. And as I emphasize, natural selection doesn't care what happens after you've reproduced. So since most of the impact of schizophrenia is past reproductive ages, or at least much of it is, that's part of the reason. But I think it's only part. One other explanation, I haven't mentioned it, but it was promulgated by a fellow named Cochrane. He said that there are a number of human diseases that are clearly appear to be caused by multiple genes. I don't think schizophrenia is a single gene. It's many genes acting cooperatively. There are many such traits in the human. Why are they so common? Why haven't they been weeded out more rarely? His explanation is that probably many of these are infectious. And his favorite example is Helicobacter. For ulcers, which for a long time was thought to be anything but bacterial, but has now turned out to be. He thinks, and there's a little bit of evidence for this, that for some of the heart diseases and such, there may be microorganisms involved. At the moment, this is a rather weak idea, but it's deserving of some exploration, I think.
I'd like to ask a really basic question, which probably everyone else
not
in the room...
Not that the rest of these haven't been basic.
Probably everyone else in the room understands this. I understand the examples that you're using in terms of evolution over hundreds of years. But can you explain to me, from an evolutionist viewpoint, how the whole thing got started, the universe, the whole package, if you will? How did it get started from the beginning?
I wish I knew.
Okay. Is that the view of evolutionists?
It's the view of many evolutionists. There's a whole field of cosmology.
Yeah.
And I think, without being an expert in this field, I find the Big Bang theory rather appealing.
Mm-hmm. And that would be what?
That's it all started with a big explosion. Mm-hmm. And that all of the elements were created in a few microseconds, or many, yeah, microseconds.
And then what was it that exploded?
What did it?
what was it that exploded?
Well, it wasn't anything there to begin with, according to this theory.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of believe it's possible to have something out of nothing.
Ah, okay.
I find it hard to understand. Yeah.
A grandson who's autistic, and there's been so much study being done on autism that geneticists looked at whether or not what has happened will continue through genetics, because I'm also thinking that so many autistic people really don't look for relationships with other people.
There are dozens, hundreds, thousands of human diseases. Most of the ones that we'd really like to know something about are fairly common ones, like autism. Almost all the common ones have a complicated explanation. We do know enough to know that hardly any of these are simple Mendelian traits. If you ask for almost any of the common diseases, diabetes, for example, there's the ordinary statistical studies show that there's a very large genetic component. That maybe 60 or 70 or 80% of the variability in the population is due to the genetic differences. And yet if you try to isolate those genes, and people are getting pretty good at this nowadays, it comes nowhere near finding all of them that ought to be there to have this explanation. So what accounts for the gap? I think, but nobody knows, I think probably the remaining genes, the ones we haven't found, are genes with individually very, very small effects. And that they cumulatively add up to the effect. I think there's good reason for thinking this is true other than just the announcement that I've made. And I've devoted a great deal of my time in the last few years thinking about how one could possibly study this. But it's not obvious. These are exactly the kind of things that are hard to study because they're individually having such small effects. Yet I think they're important. Now this doesn't answer your specific question. The reason I haven't answered is because I don't know.
Aren't we as human beings evolving? I mean, I look at my own family with the intermarriages and things like that, that we've all changed. We will be changing in a couple of generations to something else. I don't know. We're all going to look different, maybe. Maybe, you know, we're going to be darker. Maybe we'll have slant eyes. I don't know. Isn't that true?
Definitely. I fully expect changes, but don't ask me to predict what they'll be. If I'm asked, not that you asked, but if I'm asked to predict what will happen with respect to human heredity in the next 100 or 200 years. I might try to make predictions based on the past, but I think those are pretty useless. I think the human behavior in the future is going to be determined by humans. And it's what we decide. Do we have contraceptives? Do we don't? Do we have populations that are expanding? Do we have populations that are contracting? These kind of things are going to change the makeup of the population, not in ways we can either control. In fact, no, we don't understand them very well. So if yours is the question, are we really changing? My answer is yes. Can I predict the changes? The answer is no to that. I can understand the question. How do I account for the fact that all living things have a limited lifetime?
Exactly.
Yes. Why aren't some people immortal? I think the simplest answer to this is to say that evolution takes place between generations rather than within a generation. So if I had a species that lived forever, it would stop evolving. So I think partly this is the result of evolutionary history. Now, there are many details in any particular case about what determines lifespan. To me, it's interesting that this is not your question, but I got carried away. The human lives longer after reproduction ceases than almost any other mammal. Now, why is that? I think it's likely that people live longer so they can take care of their children and possibly even take care of their grandchildren. So I think that because of our highly social structure, there's reason to live longer than relative to reproduction age than other animals. But what determines the length in the first place? It must be some kind of a balance between the desire to evolve more rapidly and the clear advantages that come from a longer time. One other thing. It's nice to develop slowly. And one of the advantages of being a human is it takes 20 or 30 years to develop. And that means we have time to learn, get experiences. And I don't think that's any accident. I think the fact that we live so much longer than chimpanzees has to do with the fact that we learn more than chimpanzees do. But anyhow, one consequence of this is that because of living a longer time, we have more time each generation for mutations to accumulate. So maybe we are, by our increased longevity and increased in age of reproduction, that we have brought on a problem of ourselves from mutation. That's a delicate subject, and I'm not sure of myself, so enough said.
But can we predict that humans will evolve into less warlike creatures? Because if we do not, we will exterminate ourselves, and that will end evolution.
Well, I think it's a good guess we will exterminate ourselves. But I don't want to count on it, and I want to take every possible precaution against it. But a nuclear war could certainly exterminate lots of people. And I think we should work awfully hard to prevent it. Of course, my answers are not nearly as imaginative as you'd like to have. I think one deals with these as social problems, not as biological, really.
Yeah.
I don't think I can predict anything about whether we're going to become more altruistic in the future or less altruistic. All these depend on the kind of things that I understand, but not in the kind of detail that would be required to make any predictions.
But ultimately, we have to believe that something can develop out of nothing, an explanation of what began everything.
I think if you accept the Big Bang theory, you essentially assume that. Now, there are variations on this that assume that this universe had a previous universe from which we evolved, and that the previous one had a previous one to that. That takes us nowhere. I call it, it's an infinite regress.
Well, the question I have is on the Big Bang theory, how could human thought, emotions, love, hate, develop out of a Big Bang of material objects?
Well, I don't think Big Bang helps a bit in understanding this. But I do think that study of evolution helps, because included in the study of evolution is the evolution of altruistic, unselfish behavior, and that's part of what evolutions are trying to understand. Now, I think the other side of your coin is there are going to be many things that science can't answer, and I'm aware of these as the next person. I want to answer whatever questions we can answer by scientific trickery, and then there are other questions that we simply have to agree we can't answer, and that they're in the realm of some other aspect of human experience, human thought.
Let me begin by saying I'm a great believer in breaking down interdisciplinary barriers that different academic disciplines sort of contribute to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And as a sociologist, I've always taken the viewpoint that the longer period of maturation of the human child than almost any other species has a great relationship to our almost need to live in groups, and this is a basis of society. I'd like your comments.
I agree. I think a byproduct of this is, I'm repeating what I said a while ago, by living longer, or taking longer to mature, we have more time to educate and become adjusted to the society and do all the sort of things that learning involves. There's plenty of debate about how much learning and teaching there is in the animal kingdom, but certainly we do more of both. than most other organisms. So I think this long period of reproduction has its function. And that's one of the reasons we're as successful as we are, is that having postponed reproduction. The first part of your question, I've kind of forgotten the question now.
Well, I simply started out by noting the tendency of some people to draw strict barriers between disciplines.
You know what I wanted to say in response to that? I read a book by E.O. Wilson called Consilience, and to me that made a deeper impression. He carries this further than I would want to carry it, but it's his view that the kind of thing that's happening, science does things now that in the past were regarded as the sole province of other subjects. And so science keeps accumulating or spreading or invading, you might say. He thinks there's no end to this. And he predicts that all of the world will finally succumb to an explanation by scientific explanations. It's a very erudite book, and I certainly recommend reading it. But I don't myself go along with it all the way, much as I admire Wilson. Yeah.
I have always thought that it's pointless for science to argue with religion. And I don't know why we get caught in it. There are rules of science, and it's based on observation and reproduction. Religion or mythology never makes that claim that you have to observe a thing. It's more, it's a completely different realm of thought.
Yes, I agree.
And so I... When the argument about whether we should treat, creationism
or,
in the public schools along with evolution, well, let them teach it in the history of mythology or religion, but not teach it in science, because it is not based on observation.
Well, I agree with you. In fact, I was frequently asked this question. I said, should courses in... creationism and intelligent design be taught in universities? I say yes, but not in science courses. I'm inclined to agree with everything you said, which is probably the best answer. One of the things that actually goes way back to Darwin's time, Huxley said this too, evolution teaches us what's happened. It doesn't teach us how to behave. And it's our business to introduce through social custom behavior patterns that are socially good. And there's no way, evolution is not interested in the social good. It's only interested in survival. So there's a lot to be said beyond the study of evolution. It's just that my life is obsessed with it.
The foregoing program featured Professor Emeritus James F. Crow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The program was hosted by Capitol Lakes and recorded by the Madison Institute. For other thought-provoking programs, please visit our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the host.